everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith podcast for March 2016. I'm your host, Jonathan Butcher, and the good-looking man sitting in front of me today is Mr. Tim Nelson. Tim, great to be with you again.
Hey, John. Good to be with you. I didn't know how you felt until now.
Well, now you know.
Okay. I'll be thinking on that.
Just a little more than a week ago was the biggest event I consider to be, anyway, the biggest event in movies, the Oscars. I believe you watched the Oscars, is that correct?
I did watch them because I know you're very enthusiastic about it. I've been trapped by three small children in my home on a Sunday night.
Uh-huh.
So I watched them.
Just for record, I was also equally trapped by three small children, but that's okay. Part of the fun, right. You know? Yeah. Yelling at them to be quiet for 4 hours is fantastic. But you watched the Oscars. Now, what was your opinion of Chris Rock? There was a lot of controversy about, you know, reactions to him. How do you think he handled things?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I don't even feel prepared to answer this question. I thought he was funny. I mean, that's kind of like that's his vocation, is to be funny.
Right.
I thought he did say things. He has an ability to say things that are very serious and make them sound funny, which I guess that's part of being a comedian, too. I thought he addressed it to a certain degree, but I also think it was a very well-manufactured experience that incorporated as many black people as you possibly could without right. actually giving parody to black people within the actual Oscar with the Academy Awards.
I read that he didn't run any like his monologue by anyone. That the first time they heard it was on the night. I find that a little hard to believe, but that's what they say.
Yeah, I think that they probably gave him. I've seen him on like TV interviews and stuff, and mm-hmm. he is really quick and he can react well. And he even did that. You can see it several times in the awards.
Yeah,
I thought he did a good job.
Yeah, I thought he was a good like equal opportunity offender. You know, like there was a lot of controversy about the lack of African American nominees, and I thought he kind of like treaded that line of mocking both sides of the argument. You know, if you were like, if you thought that it was all just a bunch of overhyped controversy, he kind of mocked you. And if you thought that the other end of things that Hollywood's really racist, he mocked you too. So I don't know. Like, it's just
he's talking about the sorority.
Uh huh. Right. Sorority racist. Yeah.
I look at most significant racism, or you know, and I'm probably not an authority. Well, I know I'm not an authority on this, but if you look at most kind of significant things where people are excluded, it does have that feel of the sorority, right?
Yeah, no,
and,
right.
Totally. So I think he kind of nailed that. I think that's very powerful in to make that observation.
Now, the biggest thing I had with the Oscars, I thought Chris Rock was okay, but like just the directing of the show this year, I don't know what was up, but it felt like just really clumsy transitions between bits, and like some of the skits just didn't work at all. It just completely fell flat. I don't know. It just felt like the direction was really off. It kind of felt uneven to me. And there were surprises, of course. Sylvester Stallone did not win. He was like a dead lock in every article you could possibly read. But Mark Rylance beat him for Bridge of Spies. And Ex Machina won Best Special Effects, which was crazy. And then, of course, you have the biggest surprise of the evening. Spotlight wins Best Picture instead of The Revenant, which I think we were both rooting for.
I was pretty upset about that,
yeah,
honestly.
I know.
Have you seen both of those films? I felt like I had seen Spotlight before, but just in a different format.
So you did finally see it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I feel like Spotlight is very much like the recycled, the newspaper team that finds the scandal.
Yeah.
And of course, this is probably one of the more significant scandals of our time. But I don't think that compared to The Revenant, when you're looking at the what went into that film.
Totally.
I don't see how you can even compare the two.
I don't understand just Spotlight in general, and it really starts to worry me because like I've heard so much love about it that I'm starting to think that I just missed something, or I was in a bad mood the night that I saw it. But something that, and since you've seen it, like when I watched it, like it felt like it was like intellectually I understood, you know, the pain of the victims and this whole crisis that was happening with the sexual abuse, but like I didn't feel it. Like there was something off about the emotions of the movie. Did you get that at all, or is that just me?
I think it was intentional. Like when I've read stuff about it, like the idea was that you didn't want to get a firsthand, you wanted a secondhand version of the events.
But does that work on a film audience level?
I think it creates tension because like otherwise, like, because, I mean, I think of, you know, we talk about McKee sometimes.
Right.
I think with story, you've got to have the tension. And I think with that, that story doesn't have tension. It's just tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And not like classic tragedy, but I mean, it's just awful. And the tension of that is discovering it. And that's what drives the story. Now, if you're just like, these horrible things happen, let's think about it and let's look at the victim's perspective. Like, there's not a whole lot of story in that.
Mm.
As much as that sounds callous,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't drive a film to just a horrible thing happening doesn't drive a film.
But you have to feel something in a film, and that's what was lacking. I wanted to feel the pain, and I didn't. It felt that it was just more of a mental exercise. I don't know.
So this may seem crass, but like that film like reminds me of Moneyball in some ways.
Which I also didn't like.
Well, basically, it's like a group of people who discover the secret of something that everybody should already know, but nobody's willing to look at. Moneyball. And I'm like, is that really... It just seems like it's been done over and over and over again.
Yes, and we're both in agreement. The Revenant, by far, just is the right, like you said, the amount of work that went into it, just everything you could want in a movie is there in The Revenant. It takes you on an epic journey, and it's just such a bummer, man. You know, Alejandro won Best Director twice in a row, and we were hoping.
Part of me wonders, like, can they give the guy everything two years in a row?
Yeah, right. Like, there was some pushback. And it, actually, I was reading some stuff about that there's some people, like, the voters were actually just had, I think, that in the back of their mind, like, you know, whatever. I'm just, like, just because I'm not doing it. But yeah, Alejandro, you had mentioned this is like the Spielberg of our time. Like we get to be in this moment where this guy is making incredible movies year after year. It's like, what is he going to do next? It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the Oscars. And yeah, so for me, the film year, the next stage of the year doesn't really get started until the Oscars are over. So I've still been kind of in 2015 headspace all the way until the Oscars. And so now finally, in the last week, I was able to take a breath and just sort of think about, all right, here we are in a new year, 2016. And I'm excited because one of the first like good movies that came out in 2016, according to the critics, was Hail Caesar, but it came out like all the way back in February 6th, I believe. And so I thought we had missed it and that we were gonna have to wait till DVD, but it was still playing at a local indie theater by us, and so we were able to catch it. And that is what we are going to talk about today: the start of the first of the new year, Hail Caesar. And so, here we are. But before we dive into the film itself, I want to talk about the Coen brothers. What is your take on the Coen brothers, Tim?
Like, in general?
Just in general. Like, looking at the way they make movies and their filmography is just a flyby. Yeah.
So the first movie I saw theirs was Raising Arizona.
Okay, which I still haven't seen, and I know that's horrible because it's a classic. I know.
It's okay. It's old.
Yeah.
And I have only probably seen half of their catalog.
Okay.
So I'm not, which is kind of irresponsible to say, but that's real. Okay.
Keeping it real.
And then, yeah, they're zany. They have a way of like taking, what I like about them is they juxtapose very serious ideas with very, and kind of characters that are based on real people with comedy. And kind of comedic circumstances. And then they're not afraid to take characters through kind of insane situations or nonsensical situations that don't actually add up to anything. And so I really, just for that, I really like them.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a way of like taking high ideas and then kind of pointing out the absurdity in them by putting those ideas into characters into strange situations, which I like.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can see that in, so I think Raising Arizona, you look at, I know you haven't seen it, but you look at H.I. McDonough, and he's this convict, but he's got like a real philosophy. And I think you see that same character repeated in Clooney in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Which I love.
Yeah.
Fantastic film. Yeah. That's one of my favorites of theirs for sure. But yeah, I know what you're saying. And those zany situations appear all over that one. And of course, I mean, well, there's Fargo. You can't really have a discussion without Fargo, but you've seen that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's kind of two sides to them. But even in Fargo, there's a little bit of the ridiculous, too. I mean, there always is, right? I mean, I still think of that scene with the where they stumble upon the dude putting the other guy into the meat... or the, you know, the machine.
Chipper,
yeah,
Shredder.
The wood chipper. Yeah, there's like, it's horrible and ridiculous at the same time. And yeah. Mm-hmm. What else of theirs? Big Lebowski, which I think we both appreciate. It took me a while on that one. First time, I just did not understand what the hype was about, but I watched it a few times, forced myself to, and I do appreciate that movie now. Brother, we're out there. We talked about True Grit.
It's a remake.
Yeah, but it was good. And
so it was Big Lebowski, by the way.
It was a remake of
it's,
what?
It's based on, it's an homage piece to Murder, My Sweet, which is like a really? Film noir, I think, from, yeah.
Okay.
Which I didn't know until I watched Murder, My Sweet, and I was like, that's Bunny Lebowski.
There you go.
It's just toned down. The Bunny in Murder, My Sweet doesn't do the same things that Bunny in Big Lebowski does.
Right.
But it is, like, the characters are all, it's very clearly, like, it's almost allegorical, not quite.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times they're recycling ideas, characters, films, and you'll see that as we discuss the latest one.
Mm-hmm. And most recent movie I loved of theirs was Inside Llewyn Davis. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Oscar Isaac. I don't know what connected with me with that movie, but like just this is the music. I guess I'm a huge fan of like folk music and stuff. So that was the music. But and then it was kind of my biggest introduction to Oscar Isaac. I hadn't really seen him in anything before that, and so I just that movie really worked and a great supporting performance from John Goodman as well in that one. So, yeah, Inside Llewyn Davis. But for me, like, the thing about the Coen brothers is they can be kind of hit or miss for me, right? So, like, I just feel like you, like, sometimes I totally jive with what they're doing, and then sometimes they feel so, like, lofty and pretentious, almost, and they leave me hanging. It's like their movies are always well-made and always interesting, but there's never any guarantee I'm going to love them. This is kind of my thing. No Country for Old Men. I wanted to bring that up because I know you had said at one time you thought that was an extremely offensive movie because of its nihilism, right?
I've read some other stuff on it now, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, keep going with your thought.
No, I enjoyed that movie for what it is. I think it's very well acted, well made, but I totally understand where you're coming from with the nihilism, and it's kind of something that another Coen Brothers movie of mine that I just hate, A Serious Man. It's like kind of the same thing there where you have this, it's like it's so well made and it's leading you on this journey and you're on the edge of your seat, and then to me it just doesn't go anywhere, and then it just ends with this horrible anticlimactic ending. Both, I think, A Serious Man and No Country for Old Men, which ends with like that Tommy Lee Jones monologue, it's just like, and then it's over and you're like,
so
what?
They're dissonant endings.
Yes.
But I wouldn't say that they don't end. So, like with No Country for Old Men, the thing that has changed my mind on is I was reading about the idea that we live in a time where the old heroes don't work, and so you have is it Duvall character who's kind of like the old hero? He's the old man in that. Is that who it is?
It's been way too long, and I've forgotten. Sorry,
but he's like morally, you know, above board. He's consistent in his actions. He is going to fight for the right thing to do, no matter what. And I think in the end, he either bites at us. I can't remember the film because it's been a long time.
Yeah,
I should
have
watched it before we podcast.
Right?
But you know, you can only watch so many films.
Exactly.
It's that time of year. I'm watching all kinds of stuff.
Yep.
But I read some stuff that basically said it's that even the title, like No Country for Old Men, is saying that we live in like a really complex kind of time where the old kind of archetypes of what a hero is don't work anymore. And so they were kind of looking at that idea.
When you have that incredible evil represented in Javier Bardem's character, you know, that guy who just killing.
He's arbitrary.
Right. With the coin, right?
Would he even be evil, or is he just like, he's like an event. He's like a force in nature. He's not even like evil.
He's not even a character almost. He's
no,
because like,
he doesn't have like emotion. He's not, he just does things.
Right.
So, you know, I look at him as like, how different is he than a tornado? Like in the,
Serious Man.
Like, is he much different than a tornado or cancer? Not much. He's a really bad thing that seems to arbitrarily strike things.
So you are okay with the ending to A Serious Man?
I'm more okay with Serious Man than I am with No Country for Old Men.
Okay.
But I need to revisit that movie again.
Yeah.
With A Serious Man, I've watched that more recently. And I look at that as a contrast to, like, the idea of, like, this moral evil that is based on our choices, and then there's just like these arbitrary evil things that just happen.
Like a tornado.
Like a tornado or cancer. Like he gets the cancer call.
Right.
And so, like, I look at that as in the midst of this thing where he thinks he's having this moral crisis. If he does the right thing, then the right thing will happen to him.
Mm.
And he needs to be really morally upright. And then the universe did, you know, or whoever you would say, God, the universe, whatever, right?
It's, right.
God's heavy in that movie.
Yeah.
Deals him, like, his kid, it looks like his kid's going to get hit by a tornado and he's going to have cancer. Which nobody can choose. Like, there's no choices for those things, right?
Yes.
And so kind of looking at the...
But it's a non-ending. I mean, come on. I mean, but, it's but a cop-out.
It's not critiquing... But it's... No, it's not. It's critiquing us. Because I think we think that there's deals to be made with God or with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And if we sit on the right side of the deal, then the good thing will happen. And both those films are saying, no, that's not the case. Like, you could be doing all the right things and you could still have this horrible thing happen.
But we don't know if something horrible is going to happen because he just looks in the sky and then it's over. That's what I'm saying.
I think, but it implies you've got to
pick. I don't like implies. Like there's times where it works. Like, I just watched one movie that was Mississippi Grind, which was like about this gambler or whatever. And at the end of the movie, like he finally gets his big score and then he gets back in his car and he's going to, like, you know, change his life around. And then, comes on the record player is this like poker like a dude on CD and he all of a sudden he like stops dead in his tracks like shit, and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, is he gonna go back and like go back to his life of addiction? Like, that works, okay, but I feel like it's very rare to me that the non-ending, like, choose your own adventure style of ending does not annoy me.
So like with Serious Man, sorry, this is like my mind in Serious Man, the bully that chases the kid day after day after day after day after day stops chasing the kid when the tornado comes in. So it's saying something about,
okay,
like, when we acknowledge, like, that this is arbitrary and that this is, like, affects everyone, that somehow it, like, creates, some kind of, destroys the animosity between us, which is, like, a really kind of heavy, big statement to make with a very seemingly kind of eccentric little film, right?
It is.
I see that as something that maybe they connect to that idea. I mean, I don't know what my assumption is, that they're probably... I don't know their faith or whatever.
I don't either.
But I think I remember it, like, that they're probably more, ethnically Jewish, but probably not practicing.
Right.
But my guess grew up with the knowledge of their faith and the tradition of that.
But God appears in almost every one of their movies in some form, mm-hmm, or fashion, and even in this one, which brings us to Hail Caesar, which is the latest Coen Brothers movie, and a little plot synopsis for you. This is basically... at its heart, a film about Hollywood, old school Hollywood, I guess you could say, but there's a lot of resonance to New Hollywood too. It takes place in the 50s. This guy named Eddie Mannix, played by Josh Brolin, is this, quote, Hollywood fixer. That's what they call him in the synopsis. And he's like this guy who deals with all the problems that appear in a studio, like with celebrities or like the movie, problems on set. And so you have this guy named Eddie Mannix, and he is so basically he starts the day every day at the crack of dawn, and he's going all over the studio as all of these movies are being made left and right, and he's dealing with all these problems. And the big movie of the that's going on at Capitol Pictures, which is where he works, is this Christ story called Hail Caesar, and it stars this big star at the time, or in this world, Baird Whitlock, who's played by George Clooney, and Baird ends up getting kidnapped and taken off the set, and Eddie's got to track him down and get the movie back on track, and that's Hail Caesar. So, interesting thing, Tim, is we keep seeing movies that open up with a shot of a crucifix.
Yeah, it is kind of weird, right?
It is weird. Yeah. That's not a throwaway shot. Like, I mean, Christ is kind of a central motif of this movie, and like one of my favorite scenes is when Eddie is pulls together a bunch of these religious leaders to try and make sure that this Christ story they're telling is not offensive to anyone and that they're on the right track with it. And I love that scene because you have all of the, you know, you have a rabbi, you have a regular Protestant pastor and everything. And so he's basically like, oh, so what do you think of the movie? And they just end up getting into an argument over theology and about who Jesus is. And I don't know. I think it's a great scene.
What's funny is like they're like, you know, they go around each person, but it seems like they're more, he wants them to like be offended by it. Right. So he's like, hey, is this offensive to anybody?
Not you think really. Eddie wants them to be offended?
No, I think he wants to make sure they're not.
Right. Right.
And they're like very clearly not offended at all.
Yeah.
Because the whole kind of the running gag of that is that, and you get to the, you know, you probably were thinking about talking about this later, but like where you have the person that plays Christ and they get asked if they're an extra or if they're a principal actor, and they're I think I'm a principal, I'm not sure. So they're like, well, it makes a difference because you get a sack lunch or something if you're a principal.
Exactly.
Which is funny because it's a tale of the Christ, right? Like that's And I because there's films in that era that did that same thing, which is like, well, we don't want to actually get into the Jesus part of this because it's just too inaccessible for people and it'll offend too many people.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, why don't we get into the, we'll have a side story that kind of touches on the Jesus stuff here and there, which is like totally, you know, that's totally Ben-Hur.
Right. Exactly. And that scene where George Clooney is like getting water or something and he gets that's totally out of Ben-Hur, right?
Although
it's been a long time since I've seen
Ben-Hur. Me too.
Yeah.
There's a combination of three films that, from what I read, there's mm-hmm. a combination of three different films that are kind of like that film that they're making, which is kind of smart because they're drawing from a whole era.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like you have Spartacus, you have Ben-Hur. There's another one, I can't remember the name of it, which when they have like that banqueting scene where they put the stuff in his drink, that's from another film.
Ah,
okay. It's like directly from this other film. But the idea is like they're pulling from this era where it's like the era of the epic Christ film. It's funny because I think we talked about Ben-Hur when we were talking about the Tarantino film. Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
We're talking about 70mm, I think, right? Wasn't that a 70mm film?
I think it was.
And it was this era of these huge films, but like it's supposed to be a Christ. It has nothing to do with them, really,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was interesting. And then that their film would have like open with Jesus, like, and you never actually see Christ being crucified in the film, like the film of the film.
Yes.
You see people surrounding it, but you just see feet all the time.
You do. There's that great moment with George Clooney where he has this, I think it was a really good monologue about like, you know, Jesus and everything. Mm-hmm. And then it ends with this, you know, punchline where he forgets his line. But I don't know. Yeah.
That's really good. Yeah. But I think what's interesting about the character of like it's Maddox, right? Mannix? I can't always forget.
Eddie Mannix, yeah.
Mannix. Well, he's based on a real guy, but that's the part, the way they portray him is that he's really devout.
Right. I mean, he's visiting a priest constantly.
Every day.
Yeah, almost too much, according to the priest anyway. He's like, it's really too much. He runs ideas past him. So, yeah, that's a huge part of the film, too. Yep.
He talks about his personal temptations.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Mannix is like, it's not like he's like super above board or something, but he is very much devout. Like that's where he ends his day, right?
Exactly.
And so when he comes down, he is a very devout man.
Yeah. So, and I think like in this movie and in a lot of the Coen Brothers movies, you have Christ presented in a more of an overt way than normal, right? And they handle it well. So you have George Clooney and Josh Brolin, but you have all these little side stars too in this one. Ralph Fiennes shows up as this prestigious director. Channing Tatum is awesome.
He's really good.
Yeah, he is. I don't know what it is. I'm not a huge Channing Tatum fan. I've just never been on board with him, but like you got to admit, this guy has talent. I mean, like mm-hmm. he has this song and dance number in there that's just like, it's amazing, truly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, Hobie is this is character that's played by this. I've never seen him. Maybe I have, but this guy named Alden Ehrenreich. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but he was good in it too. Like country western star. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like the. I mean, everybody's got a parallel, like of mm-hmm. real people that in that era, like the mm-hmm. post-war era, and so he's like your Gene Autry / who's the other guy in the era. Roy Rogers,
yeah, probably. Yeah.
So he's like this guy that is incredibly talented, but that talent isn't what anybody wants anymore, right?
Yeah.
But the irony of that, because he's at the end of that era, and so they're like, well, can we transition him to something else now? Because people are like, they're still laughing at those films, but that's almost over. He's from a silent era. I mean, I don't know how they bridged all that, but mm-hmm. you know, he went from that you could be a lead in a movie and have no lines,
mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Yeah.
And now it's like, no, you've got to talk. And they're trying to transition him into like this debonair kind of lead.
Yeah. He has that great like fish out of water thing. He's on Ralph Fiennes' film set and he's right. like has this dialogue, but he still sounds like a country bumpkin and it's not right. working.
Which is like just great comedy, but it's also like mocking like the whole idea. Like, I don't know if you picked up on like dialectic idea.
Mm-mm.
So like there's a, Hegel talks about a dialectic. So they're all into philosophy, these guys.
Yes.
And the communists talk about it because it influences Marx and Engels when they write about communism. And the idea is that history has, there's thesis, antithesis, synthesis. So like there's one movement, then there's a reaction to that movement. And then there's like the kind of combination of, or the, they take, you take the best from both movements and that becomes the new thing. And that happens over and over in history. And it's a progressive view of history so that things are getting better and better. So that when you look at the, one of the things that's cool about that film is it mocks the dialectic, but it also like falls into it. Hmm. So like with the country guy, it's like he's the old, that's the old way that they did film prior to this. And now they're forcing him. So that's the old way that made all kinds of money and that, you know, was the way to be a film star was to like rope and ride and like, you know, be an action star.
Yeah.
And sing like a country song. And nobody's interested in that anymore. Now what they want you to do is like, you know, be the debonair leading man that can
go to the party and win the woman, right?
Win the woman. It's more nuanced. And then the funny thing for us is, right, we're watching these old, these kind of versions of old film thinking they're super hokey. And then,
but they're also kind of interesting.
They're yeah. interesting, but what they've done is they've taken them, they've combined it with modern film, and now they have the synthesis of those two things, which is the actual film itself, which is kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
So they've created a dialectic. And this is the result, is this film, which they're mocking dialectic, because there's all these dialectic jokes throughout the whole movie. I thought it was pretty witty, which they're always going to be witty.
Right, they are.
That's who they are.
Yeah, totally.
But it's funny, because our reaction to all these things is, man, these are so hokey. This is so terrible. But I found myself, like, I mean, how did you react to the...
Well,
it was like Anchors Away, basically. I can't remember. It's the sailors tap dancing scene in the bar.
How did you love react that. To that? I thought it was incredible. I really did. Like,
it's corn, right? It's
I mean,
junk.
It is, but it's not. I mean, you even like. Like you have that one, like you mentioned, him doing the guitar solo or whatever on the set, and then this one, you know, guy like he's trying to kill the moon or something, and he sees the moon reflected in the pool, and he jumps in to try to get the moon. I mean, that that's cheesy, but the sailor scene, I don't know, like I'm down with that.
Yeah, so like I guess each generation would look at that and be like, oh, this is cheesy,
mm-hmm.
and. I think they're saying like that this is part of like you have to go through this. And then they also even like are dealing with the idea of, well, there's two ideas, which is either this is like either film is totally about capital and making fun and making more and more money. And it has nothing to do with art, or it's a highly artistic endeavor that can actually alleviate suffering, can bring meaning into the people's lives. And so I think they are probably dealing with, like, how do those two interact, and how, and can there be a synthesis of that? And I don't know if there can. That's a good question.
It is. And we will get to that soon. The question, though, I have for you is, so we talked about some great individual moments. Overall, is this a good movie?
It's a smart movie, but not a good movie.
Okay. Elaborate.
I just don't think it's very, it's kind of, it's a fun movie. You're kind of like on a, it's like you're going through this like tour of curiosities,
mm-hmm, right?
And the acting is good, and the characters are kind of eccentric, and there's so much like allusion and homage to all these other things. But at the end of it, like, I don't know how compelling that story is. There a story in there?
Exactly. Yeah, my thoughts exactly. I mean, yeah, it's a fun ride. It's breezy entertainment. But at the end of the day, where is there any true substance to the film? Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I guess I'd have to classify as good, not great. I mean, and that's okay. I mean, it's still a cut above your average, you know, C-plus movie that comes out, you know.
I mean, would I watch it over the Transformers, Age of Ultron
right,
or something?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's above average. However, we're not talking about a great film. It's not going to be something that we're going to come back to at the end of the year and think about, but it's okay. Yeah, it works in the moment. Good, mm-hmm. not great. Yeah.
Makes me wonder if they're putting out too many films.
Are they? Well, I mean, well, their last one was Inside Llewyn, right?
And so that's like 2 years ago.
Yeah,
but they put fairly... out, how many films they have? Like they have 12 films or something like that.
It's not a lot if you think about it. I
over,
mean,
over like 25 years.
Yeah, I think it's about the right quantity. Yeah. But So yeah, so you have these individual moments that work. You know, I loved the, like I said, the scene with the religious leaders, the Channing Tatum number, Hobie's little scene. So, but then there's moments that didn't quite work, like Tilda Swinton's character. Their characters, she plays these twins. I did not get that at all. It just fell flat to me. I really don't. Honestly, like Eddie Mannix, like, do we connect with him? Like, do we really understand him or get inside him at all? Like, I mean, he's an engaging lead, but I just feel like I never really understood his character. I don't know. Good movie, but you were touching on some of the themes, and I think there are some compelling themes, even if it wasn't a classic film. You were getting to the idea of art, and I want to talk about that too, but I just got to say up front, like, and you alluded to some of the references in this movie, and I feel like this is the biggest thing I sometimes have with the Coen brothers, is it feels like I'm watching a 2-hour inside joke that I'm not a part of. And you know, like you said, you talked about doing research, and I'm sure that if I went and did a bunch of research on all the things that they were referencing, I would go, oh, okay, I get it. But it's like when someone tells you a joke that you don't get in the moment, you know, and then they explain it to you and you're like, oh, okay. It doesn't make it retroactively like work, you know, I mean, you get it, but it's like, I feel like in the moment on a lot of Coen Brothers films, I just don't get it. And I feel like I'm just a huge believer that you should give everything to your audience that they need to fully enjoy your movie without having all these other elements that you need to go research to enjoy it or have the intellectual prowess to enjoy it. Like,
so would you like flesh Woody Allen then?
Well,
because I feel like Coen Brothers are very similar.
Yeah, I'm not hugely familiar with all of Woody Allen's works. I like the one Crimes and Misdemeanors is one of the few I've seen of his, and I didn't think that was that way at all. But I don't know. But okay. So you mentioned the three Christ stories that it connects to. What other things did you pick up on that they're referencing?
Oh, you mean just as far as like films and stuff?
Yeah.
Or I mean, obviously, like they're drawing off of these three films that are supposed to be about Christ, but really aren't.
Right.
which were really popular at the time, right? Post war. Uh-huh. They also, like, you know, we didn't talk about Scarlett Johansson's character, but she's
she plays this like mermaid.
It's like a $1 million mermaid.
Yes.
And so there's all these kind of hokey films, or like I said, Anchors Away for the sailor scene, and even the like the location of that house that the communists were in or whatever is like, that's some other, I don't even know what film it is, I can't remember, but that's also another film. So the whole thing is just kind of paying tribute to those, kind of that era, and kind of it was kind of ludicrous.
Yeah.
And then what I think is funny is, well, I was thinking, because like you have these, like, what's the point of these gossip columnists, right?
They told us when plays.
Yeah. So I'm kind of beginning, well, what's funny is there's two, because in reality there was one. Like there's an actual, she's based on one, but there's two, right? So this is playing with the dialectic idea, I think.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that I look at is that a lot of the storyline is basically, if we believe the gossip columnist, that just plays out. It's like all Hollywood screenwriters are communists, right? And they are. And this person really had this person's baby, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like, if all of our wild imagination, you know, if all those things actually were what was reported was real, that's kind of what this film has in it, which is kind of cool.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as far as themes, like, it's all over the place.
And I know. It's the first thing you said when we compared notes is that this film references like a million other films. And
yeah.
And you're really good at making those connections. But you know what I'm saying? Like, kind of feeling on the outside looking in sometimes. Like, I get it if it's a sequel. You know, obviously you have to see episodes, you know, 4 and 5 to enjoy episode 6 of Star Wars. But like, even a self-contained 2-hour movie, I mean, sometimes you shouldn't have to know the 50 connecting points to get a joke. But you know, maybe that's just me.
I think it's just, yeah, I think it's just style. Like, they're not going to, they have an audience, and that audience is going to be by nature limited. And if they choose to have, sometimes they choose to have real stories that are like very driven by tension in every scene.
Yes.
And sometimes they don't. And I feel like if you have a story that's driven by tension in every scene, then you can have anyone follow it.
Right, exactly. Which is probably the ones I more connect to, well, like Fargo and No Country for Old Men.
Exactly, and you don't have to get the illusions.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think if like this whole thing is basically kind of a story that's alluding to something, or talking about philosophy or playing with the idea of deity or any of those things, like that's okay, but that's not going to – it's going to have by nature a limited audience.
Right. So let's talk about some of the themes. Now, you already mentioned one. Did you pick up on – what was the main thing that grabbed you as far as the thematic element of the film?
I talked about dialectics. So, like, yes. I think that idea and the idea that the things that we now would mock are the things that at one point were highly valued.
And still probably have value, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think they play with that idea, like this idea of tradition, this idea of can we just leave tradition, or is tradition part of who we are? And I think that film asks the question of film, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is who we are. Like, we came out of this post-war environment of film, right? We came out of a million, like, you know, we're talking now because somebody, no, not exclusively because of, but somebody made $1 Million Mermaid, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, you know, a big, big picture at that point. And I think that those guys get those themes, which is like there is some element of where you cannot get away from the old.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how hard you want to, like, yes, that scene with the Anchors Away scene is still going to be good. And you're going to have a hard time, like, just going, oh, this is ridiculous. But there are other scenes that are ridiculous, like right. These Roman, like, you know, George Clooney running around in Roman garb the whole time. It's just kind of hilarious. It's, like, absurd.
It is absurd, yeah.
But I think there's other times where you're like, this is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is this idea of the playing with, and they do this with these other moves, a lot of these other moves we've talked about. Can we get rid of tradition? Can we get rid of the thing that we are basically our foundation? Can we keep building up and then try to deny our foundation?
Hmm.
And I think they would say no. They would say yes, part of this is just kind of so ridiculous that it's funny. But other parts are beautiful and wonderful, and we could never redo this at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But they're valuable. And I think that is some of what they're, you know, what they're pointing to in the movie.
They share a little bit with Tarantino in that way. And I guess maybe I'm thinking of it more because both Hateful Eight and this one open up with a crucifix. But, like, just that love for film and what's come before and that kind of reverence for that and yeah. having constantly those connecting points back to what brought us to this point.
Yeah.
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 So I'll tell you my take on it. Something that really stood out to me was it felt like the movie was kind of highlighting the magic of film as far as, like, you have all this stuff that happens before the director says action and after the director says cut, right? And it's just madness and things that happen on a film set and celebrities and gossip columnists and studio heads running around and everything. But in that moment where the camera is going and people are acting, there's magic. And I feel like you see that in the movie, right? You like in that sailor scene and in the other scenes, it's just like, that is when the movie really shines. And so that was a big theme to me, is that just highlighting what – there's a sacredness to film. And, you know, that's why I love movies so much and then why I think you do too. There's something like almost divine there, and I think it's because, to me, Jesus communicated in, you know, through stories. Mm-hmm. And I feel like stories are very intrinsic to – humanity.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about, like, Jesus could have done a bunch of sermons, but he chose to tell truth mostly through parables. The who we read about Jesus is in a book, the Bible, you know. And so to me, film is like the ultimate storytelling device, because you have all these elements that come together, writing and acting and music, all in this frame. And so to me, that is what makes film a cut apart, and kind of the sacred element to it is is this ultimate storytelling device. And so, like I was saying, it doesn't matter what your opinion is of Hollywood itself, right? That's something I always am thinking about, is like people kind of write off Hollywood as frivolous, right? Like even in the character that Eddie Mannix visits in the Chinese restaurant is always like downing Hollywood. And it's like, well, when are you going to stop that frivolous movie making?
Like, what do you produce out of this? And he produces like basically an atomic bomb.
Right. Yeah. That's so true.
That's the real business. It's not these stories. It's that we can create horrible destructive power that has the ability to destroy millions of lives. And that's real power.
And Eddie thinks about this. I mean, he's perplexed about what he should do, because he's contemplating whether he should stay in the film business or go in this other pursuit. And he even asks his priest about it, right? And he says, you know, what should I do? I feel like staying in as the head in this studio is the right thing to do, but there's also this other opportunity. And the priest says, I think you should, God wants you to do what's right, you know? And to me, you have all these other crazy, ridiculous elements in the movie, like communism, and even the communists are talking about how Hollywood is a part of the capitalistic system and everything, which is probably totally true. But then a few scenes later, you know, you have this Channing Tatum moment where they're singing and dancing, and none of that matters anymore. And
I'm sorry, I'm just thinking of the writers, but go ahead.
Yeah, and so I just feel like there's that's what it is to me. It's just like this sacredness to film, and why it is that we do Cinema Faith here is what the movie was highlighting, that between cut and action, there's something powerful going on, something life-changing, and I think Eddie realizes that too, which is why he makes the decision that he does.
So who's Caesar?
Who is Caesar?
Yeah.
So, of course, Hail Caesar is the name of the movie within the movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the name of the movie, right?
Right. Who is Caesar?
So, yeah, it's like that was the question I always ask, because, like, you know, the title means something.
Yeah, of course.
And so I guess, like, maybe my thought is, like, at the end of it, is it Mannix? I mean, like, that would be, like, what I would think, right?
Well, he certainly runs. I almost felt like he was the head of the studio, but in the plot synopsis, it just calls him the fixer. But he certainly, you know, runs it like he's.
Isn't that a view of God?
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, I think it's funny because he is like. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm getting the side notes.
No.
These are things I've been thinking. These are, you know, the shower thoughts, right? So, like, that he's described as the Hollywood fixer, so that people largely ignore him until they have a real issue, a real, like, problem that they can't fix.
Mm hmm.
And then they go to him and he figures a way out.
And everyone respects him. Like, I mean, even, you know, George Clooney comes in there all cocky at that one scene and he's talking about communism and everything, and he just slaps him around and you see it in his eyes. I mean, so you're right. He definitely has that Caesar quality to him. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was just curious. You know, I didn't know if there was an answer to that, but, you know, part of me goes, like, maybe it's like, hail these guys that kept us together, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who kept these studios going, who kept it going, you know, wait, because this is the films these guys were watching as kids.
Right.
And so there's something to, like, hey, you guys kept the studios going. You guys kept this working. You made sure that you buried this junk that these stars were dealing with so they could keep acting.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is like, hey, I appreciate, it's almost like they appreciate the tradition. Like Hail Caesar would be like, they're saying, we appreciate what you did.
Hmm.
And that would kind of line up with the film. Like it really would. So, like, Hail Caesar, you know, hail these films that you guys made, even though they seem so ridiculous now.
Yeah.
They're part of that dialectic. Like, we couldn't be here unless we had these.
They're part of what made us who we are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we can't ever go back to them, but, like, let's bring them back here.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, I guess that might make sense to me.
Yeah.
About, like, what that film is about, which is, it's like, no, we're giving credit here to these guys.
So there you go. That is the film Hail Caesar. And that's our first movie of 2016 that we had the privilege of talking about. So it's a whole new year, Tim. I mean, that's what was always exciting to me about this time is, like, you don't know what's going to happen. Like 2 years ago, we didn't know that we were going to get to a film like Birdman or Whiplash. And last year, around this time, we didn't know that we would be experiencing The Revenant. So what is 2016?
We didn't know that insurance guy was going to win Best Supporting Actor.
Get me started. No, he was good. Excuse me. But yeah, so that's what I always love about just starting a new year is you don't know what's going to come, what journeys we're going to go on.
Is there another Transformer movie coming out?
I hope not. Yeah. Desperately.
Does Michael Bay get something in the works that I need to avoid?
Michael Bay. Man, you know, Michael Bay, I honestly, he gets all this flack, but he made a couple good movies back in the day. Like, I think The Rock is a legitimately fun, good movie. I don't know.
I think I might have, like, baited you there.
Yeah. But, you know, hey, I'm just glad we can come together once a month and talk about all this. I love having conversations with you. And the movie is Hail Caesar. If you're lucky, you might still catch it at a theater near you, but you also might have to wait for DVD. Definitely worth a rental, I would say. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. I think that's probably like how I would. I would say yes. Rent this film.
Yes.
You're not going to be overawed by the cinematography and go, wow, I should have seen this in a bigger format. You'll probably be just fine with your TV at home.
But still enough to chew on to make it worthwhile.
Oh, I think it's a good film. I would say watch this film, but don't watch it twice. Well, right. Maybe. I don't know. You might be bored. You can watch it twice. Like Groundhog Day, watch it 9 times with John.
That's right. And so currently we're on pace. This could change. It's always a subject to change. But currently I believe next month we are going to try to tackle the new Terrence Malick movie, Knight of Cups. And we can talk about all things Malick. And we can talk about Story and McKee and the whole nine yards.
Oh, man. I'm going to have to get lots of rest and eat good food and be prepared for this.
So come on back next month for that. And until then, thanks, Tim, for joining us. And thank you for listening. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.